Some of the views expressed on the Mormon Channel are solely for the education and inspiration of our audience and may not represent the official position of the Church.
One of the most remarkable aspects of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is its unique history. Throughout the world, great stories from faithful church members have only added to that history. This program shares some of these incredible stories of faith, perseverance, hope, and inspiration. You're listening to Legacy. I'm your host, Nathan Wright. Oscar Wilde wrote, "Every portrait that is painted with feeling is a portrait of the artist, not of the sitter." Art then allows us to see into the souls of artists and ourselves as we connect with those feelings. Joining us today on Legacy is Rita Wright, curator of art and artifacts for the Church History Museum here in Salt Lake City. Rita, welcome to Legacy.
Thank you.
Please take a few minutes and tell our listeners about yourself.
Well, I'm actually fairly new to the Church History Museum. I've been at BYU for the last 17 years, where I taught the History of Civilization courses in the Humanities Department. And then the last 8 years, I've been at the Museum of Art there, which was a wonderful experience working with the academic community and with the amazing BYU students. But now I'm on a new adventure here at the Church History Museum and ready to go and focus a little more on the history of this people and the art that they create.
Well, congratulations on your appointment here. That's very exciting.
Thank you.
How did you get into this to begin with?
I kind of fell into it, actually. We raised our children in Southern California, and at that time, we decided we wanted to come back to Utah. I wanted to get a graduate degree. My husband's an artist, so I'd been working in the schools teaching art and came back to BYU, did a humanities degree, was going to focus on something ancient history, but had the chance to go to London with a fabulous professor there, Art Bassett, and ended up doing a master's thesis on a Victorian subject. So I really got into Victorian religious art, that amazing narrative work that was done at mid to the end of the 19th century, found that I loved working with the art. And so as opportunities came up to do a little bit more, especially the opportunity to work at the museum, I grabbed it and went over there.
You say your husband is an artist. Are you an artist as well?
Not at all. I let him do the actual production. I critique it, though.
I see. Yeah. I'm sure he appreciates that. So what actually does a curator do?
Well, the word curator comes from the idea of caring for a collection. And when museums began gathering artifacts, someone needed to take care and be responsible of those for those works. And so especially in the British situation, they call them keepers, and they keep them safe. We see in the word curator the idea of curate Band-Aids, that caring for something. And here at the Church History Museum, I work with our collections care people, and I also am responsible for new acquisitions, the works that come into the collection. And that has been a whole new experience, because collecting for the Church History Museum has a very focused, it's not just about art in general, it's about art of this people, art created by LDS artists, arts that reflect LDS themes, of course, scriptural account, and the story of this people as they moved from the eastern part of the United States westward, and now as they expand around the globe. We've got a lot of artists that contribute to our international competition, and so we're seeing that we have people who are well-trained, very interested in creating works that reflect their spiritual identity and experience as members of the church.
So not only art, but artifacts, how much has that does that have to do with your job?
Artifacts is really a fairly new thing for me. Of course, here in the Church History Department, they've been dealing with artifacts, records, as we call them, of the past, both in manuscript form, and art becomes a record. We see some of the early LDS artists like C.C.A. Christensen trying to tell the same story that were stories that were frequently told in journals that we are so interested in. So the collecting of artifacts is a very important aspect for the Church History Department, because objects tell stories. And they tell the story of the creator. They tell the story of the person using that object. They sometimes tell stories themselves about the times that the people lived in. We looked at an object the other day that is a baby bath stand from the 19th century. Who knew that they had baby baths? And so those kinds of things are very interesting, but it's our responsibility to kind of pull those stories out of those objects and learn more about, as Oscar Wilde said, the artist and the soul of the artist, the creator there, and the soul of the person using it. Why? Why was it important enough that it has been around for 150, 200 years?
Speaking of that, I was walking through just a week or two ago the Presidents of the Church exhibit, and there are just so many interesting artifacts over there, the cane of the Prophet Joseph Smith and so many different things. And it just gives you an opportunity to actually be there, you know, with them across time. It's just kind of an amazing thing.
Yeah, that way to connect through an object. And sometimes we find that people are more willing to tell their story when they've got an object in hand. Oh, this was my grandmother's lace hanky, and it was from the Kirtland, or from the Kirtland dedication. That when people are working with an object, they aren't quite as intimidated to tell about themselves. And so when we see the cane or we see Joseph Smith's cape, that there is already a connection through a tangible object to an idea, a symbol, a person beyond.
Let's talk about how you acquire items or artwork from people. I know about the competition, which is actually an invitation for members of the church to submit artwork. But what about just these artifacts you describe? How do we come about them, and how do you decide whether you're going to keep them or say thank you very much? Or
yeah, a large part of my responsibility is to kind of screen the objects that are offered to the church. We now have a call center at the Church History Museum, and maybe you can post that on your website. But we are hoping that people will, first of all, offer these objects to the call center, because we do get a lot of requests for considering these. But my responsibility in that is to take that object and to consider it both for its historical merit. Was it something that we have a clear provenance or ownership on, that we can trace back to a significant person in the church or an event? This was from the temple dedication in Ghana, kind of thing. So we look for those kinds of connections. Then the other thing we look for with artifacts as well as the works of art is their aesthetic merit. Is this something we can show in an exhibition? And quite frankly, that's where we deal with the skill of the artist. We recognize the strength and power of cultural artifacts, some of these things that come from around the world, and we acknowledge that they're very important in conveying messages about the people and the times and the places that they live. But then there's the other side of it, that if we are going to use it in an art exhibition, we have to look at the aesthetic power of that work. Has the artist used line, color, form, concept in a way that really draws us in and makes us want to see beyond those symbols, as Johnny Witzel said, the mighty realities for which they stand. So determining that is something that takes a lot of time, to kind of let these thoughts and experiences with works of art and artifacts incubate. It's meant for me a lot of museum looking, a lot of collections experiencing, so that I've become familiar with those things that have been deemed worthy of entering into a collection like the museum's.
So once something has been accepted, do you have to do a certain amount of research in order to justify it being there, in order to tell a story?
Sure. That's the art historian's role in what I do. And in fact, I have a work that's been offered to us right now, very interesting early 20th century work. And even before we go through the formal acquisitions process, I've begun researching the artist to see what kinds of information have bits of information have already been gathered. I look through other periodicals. I go online, look through an auction search to see what his works have been selling for, if indeed they have. I want to know a little bit about his background, his relationship with the church, where he studied. And so it becomes a great deal of detective work. It's just – it's that same feeling of getting on the hunt, and it draws you in. And once you start learning about the artist and that he spent some time in Paris and this particular painting is dated Paris, 1914, makes me wonder if he was going to some of those incredible avant-garde exhibitions that were there, if he knew some of these artists, who he studied with. So it becomes a story of an individual again, but then it becomes a story of my search for the connections to the church experience. Where does he sit within this great tradition of LDS art? And so it really is kind of the thrill of the hunt.
Fun. Once you've gathered a bunch of things, art or artifacts, what determines how you're going to exhibit something?
Well, once it's been accessioned into the collection, then we start looking about for ideas. And I really like to have the ideas for an exhibition emerge from what's in the collection. This is the way we did it at BYU. Sometimes you're offered outside traveling exhibitions, but when you're working with your own collection, you need to just spend time with the works. I kind of think that personal encounter as I wander down through the collections area and our storage areas, sometimes something will just jump out. I'll see a painting that maybe has not been exhibited recently, and it's where this synthesizing of ideas, background experience, of course, having a background teaching the history of civilization. I've got a good 6,000 or 7,000 years from which to draw and make connections to things that, oh, wouldn't this be interesting to look at how members of the church in this painting have depicted the Egyptian experience? And so maybe we can start exploring that. Or this other work that I'm looking at. What if we started exploring different perspectives on the pioneer experience? So ideas just emerge. I feel very strongly about a team interaction on that, that members of the church, members of the museum staff have ideas about the kinds of things they'd like to see, and listening to that and observing the kinds of things that go on in LDS media that happen in our Utah culture, that happen in the global community, any of those things can be a catalyst for an exhibition idea.
This is Legacy on the Mormon Channel. We're visiting today with Rita Wright, Church History Museum Curator of Art and Artifacts. Let's talk about some of the things that are going on in the museum right now. There's always the ongoing presidents of the church, but what are some of the other exhibits?
Right. We have three temporary exhibits up right now. Mi Vida, Mi Historia is going to be closing soon, and that's been a wonderful chance to explore testimony of some of the Latin American saints. Two of our most recent exhibitions, one deals with quilts and the connections people make to that quilting experience. It's called Pieces of Me. And it's a delightful exhibition where we see textiles taking center stage. These are indeed works of art. It's not a painter necessarily working with a brush, although we do have one work in there by Pam Bowman where she's painted a quilt and used its mixed media. It's got keys. It's got nails. And so what do those aspects of the quilt say about her and her friends and the daily rituals they engage in? And just the opportunity of experiencing the color, the line, the form in these quilts. They're very intricately done. Some of them tell stories of people in distant places, and bringing them into the museum makes us feel closer to them, that these works of art really do reflect individual stories. Then we also have an exhibition that is really a group of works that have been loaned to us. They are not at this point in the museum collection. We hope at some point maybe a few of them will be. But it's They're expressions, contemporary expressions of the artist's testimony of the Savior. They've taken scriptural account and responded to that in works of art. We have paintings. We have some fabulous sculpture in there and just some interesting art objects in glass. So it becomes kind of a view at of contemporary feeling about the Savior, and that it doesn't necessarily have to be done in a figurative painting of Jesus Christ, but that perhaps a brilliantly colored abstract painting called Pillar Number One by Clayne Graves becomes representation of Shekinah, of the divine presence of God that was in that pillar of fire that went before the children of Israel. It is not the face of Jesus Christ, literally, as we may see some artists like Del Parson paint it, but is definitely a seeking to know Jesus Christ and that brilliant aspect of glory that led the children of Israel.
I saw some of the other works online in very small depictions. Tell us about more of these on this particular exhibit.
Well, there are several. In fact, there are three in a row that just really tend to attract me because of the way they work together. One is A Descent from the Cross by Brian Kershisnik. And of course, in our culture, we've been very careful about representations of crucifixion and that aspect of the Savior's ministry and atonement. But this particular work is very poignant, and I had the opportunity recently of visiting with some of the general authorities. And as we stopped and looked at this work, we talked about Jacob 1:8 in the Book of Mormon, where it indicates to us to think about and view the Savior's death, think about the cross he bore, as well as how we must pick up and bear our own crosses. So as we look at this painting, beautiful, it's very large, of individuals taking the Savior's body down from the cross, it becomes a very quiet, sacred moment when we reflect on these individuals that loved him, that had been with him as he ministered to the people, and how they must have felt when they did not yet understand resurrection. They had been told, but at that awful moment, they were dealing with the mortal remains of the Savior, and the looks of grief on their faces, the tenderness with which they take this body down from the cross. As I spoke with the artist, Brian Kershisnik, I kind of wanted to test him, and I said, "So, Brian, have you painted yourself in here?" And he just responded that all of these have a part of me, which mm-hmm. goes back to your initial quote, that it reflects, as he thought about these individuals, what they must have gone through and how that has meaning for him personally as an artist, and then how we as viewers receive that and come to it with a certain set of beliefs and understandings that help us start making meaning.
There was one sculpture of a seated Christ with a couple of children. I don't remember what it was called, but it just seemed very majestic in a very simple way. So do you have any other favorites from this collection?
There is a work that is perhaps less easily understood because it's a conceptual work. It's by artist Ron Richmond, and it's called Evening Number 2. And number two being a number in a series, but the idea of evening plays heavily in how we interpret the painting. In the center of the work, and it's a fairly good sized work, is a chair, a very normal kind of heavy duty utilitarian chair with a beautiful white cloth draped over it. And in Ron Richmond's work, these objects, when we talk about artifacts earlier, these objects are full, loaded with meaning. They become containers of meaning. So as we look at the chair, it does seem utilitarian, but we think, what does chair stand for? Is it that idea of authority? We sit at, have someone sit at the head of a table? Is it the idea of the majesty of a throne? And yet this is a very common chair, but it's flanked by two other chairs, suggesting presidency or leadership there. And then this beautiful white cloth that is so carefully draped reminds us of the white cloth throughout the Savior's life, the white cloth of the swaddling bands, the white cloth with which he may have celebrated Passover or the Last Supper, and then, of course, that shroud in which he was buried. And to see this brilliant white cloth over the chair, it has again been discarded. He is risen, or he is no longer there. In front of the chair and the cloth is a table, some kind of a slab, that when you first look at it, it may be, oh, something that calls to mind maybe the slab of the tomb. But if you look very carefully, you can see just dimly plates, goblets, suggesting that this may have been, again, the table of the Last Supper. And this is in remembrance of him. So the whole painting kind of sets up that idea of memory and thinking about this moment when the Savior of the world left these emblems that we have the opportunity of reflecting on each Sunday. Many times, as I've looked at Ron Richmond's work, it helps me be more thoughtful during the sacrament as I recall the care with which he's crafted these pieces. And in fact, the whole central part of this painting is inscribed, kind of circumscribed. This circle sets this moment up as a significant central point that we do all things in remembrance of him. And so these works can be very important, in, I think, for members of the church in our worship. That along with scriptural study, sometimes these visual records of testimony and concepts and ideas can help us be more thoughtful in our everyday experience.
So each one of these artists are very unique in their own way. What similarities do they have that has brought this group of works together?
I think it's passion. It's caring a great deal about what they do. That, you know, I have the opportunity of working with all kinds of departments and disciplines within the church. And I see a group of people who are so devoted to doing the best that they can in whatever their area is. And these artists are the same, that they are thoughtful, they are careful. It's interesting, we go back to that word curator and taking care, but they really want to convey their ideas, their testimonies, their beliefs. And so they have trained, they have worked. It's not just something where you say one day, oh, I'm going to be an artist. But I see in these particular artists a real devotion to learning their art skills, their craft, to working through, to struggling. There is a lot of heartache and struggle as they wrestle with some of these pieces. Sometimes they just aren't working. I know that Jim Christensen, who is perhaps best known as a fantasy artist, James Christensen, that members of the church will recognize his works, but he had struggled with the painting that's in this particular collection. You know, this is a man of great artistic stature who has been doing work for years, has taught at BYU, and yet this painting of the Savior in Gethsemane had been a serious struggle for him, and he just had wrestled with it, had left it there working on it till a moment when he had an opportunity of a visiting with one of the apostles, and he just said, I can't quite make this come together. And the apostle took a look at it and said simply, it's missing the cup, the bitter cup. And of course, was the cup in the garden? No, this is a metaphor for the kind of struggling. But when he is an artist and all of his background and ability with symbol and idea took that and placed this cup on its side with just one drop, as he expressed it, almost of the bile of this bitter moment, that the painting came together compositionally, that the meaning was enhanced, and because he was in tune to receiving those kinds of insights about his work from years of experience, the painting did come together.
And there are so many different kinds of artists within the church. I remember some years ago an exhibit called Sacred Connections that was works of Native Americans, and was able to go on the road with then curator Richard Oman, and we interviewed artists and got video of their work and their studios, and it was just such an amazing experience to be there in their studios and their environments, be able to see them work.
So now, may I ask a question?
Sure.
As you went through that experience, what kinds of thoughts came to your mind? What particularly stood out where you were able to visit the site, the place it was created, and actually talk to the people that created it?
The opportunity to see the places and the reasons why these people would create the work was quite amazing. We visited one place called the Hatch Trading Post, and this was a painter, and he actually painted a scene of some years previous of his grandmother and his father in the trading post. And just to be able to see the background of what he was doing there and the feelings that were created from being there, it was very, very nice.
I think sometimes we think we have the corner on spirituality in our certain kind of Utah art or LDS art. But when we recognize that throughout the world, there are artists who try to connect, whether they understand it, and of course, in their language, is it the Great Spirit? Is it something of energy in an Eastern philosophy or experience? But there is something intuitive and sensitive about artists that make their desire to connect to a higher plane of experience a really important facet of the work. And I think as we grow in understanding and educate to that willingness to accept these works of art for how they are offered and the sincerity and both the artistic achievement and the deep spiritual connections, that we will understand our own work in a better way.
We're talking today with Church History Museum Curator of Art and Artifacts, Rita Wright. I'm Nathan Wright, and this is Legacy. The international competition is open this year. Tell us about that process a little bit.
What an exciting experience, because this is the moment where members of the church around the world, those listening today, can get online and find the information to enter a work of their own. This is where they get to flex their spiritual and artistic muscle and join it here at the Church History Museum ultimately for an exhibition to celebrate the worldwide church and the artists that are out there, those who wish to express their testimony through art, and those who are new. Those who are very experienced, we want to see it all, because there may be just some budding gem out there that we would love to take a look at and share with our other viewers.
Is there a way to describe in general terms the artists who enter the international competition, other than members of the church?
Varied, varied, yes. That, I go back to what it is about these other artists. There is just a passion for
Excellent.
What they do, a willingness to share, and that kind of open honesty. I'm really looking forward, because, of course, this will be the first competition that I'll be involved in jurying. And so to get a sense, as I've reviewed past competitions, that we see everything, every medium from every part of the world. And, of course, we have a responsibility to be able to do some fair, honest jurying or judging of those works, because there are artists who have really struggled, really worked toward this. And, of course, we want to recognize them. But we also are looking for those bits and pieces that start showing us that someone has promise or is willing to go through this process of learning more about art.
Here in the conference center where the Legacy Studio is, after the last competition, they set up a beautiful exhibit here in the conference center, just hundreds of pieces. And it was just every day when I would come to work, I could walk past these and just revel in this amazing art. It was just so great.
Kind of feeds your soul, doesn't it?
It certainly does.
Because, again, we go back to the way that we connect to an object. Now, we could sit down, we could read this story in the ensign of a person in a far-off land. But when we see a work where they've maybe taken their experience, I have a daughter-in-law from Africa, and to look at some of that traditionally styled art that members of the church take their experience with their own culture and growing and living there, and then they translate it into something that speaks as much of their spiritual experience, it just becomes a real feast for us to sort through, to look at these, to stand in front of them and connect to someone very far away.
So having just come from BYU and the Museum of Art, surely you had something to do with the Carl Bloch exhibit.
Yes, I was the lead educator on that, got to work with Don Fazy and the rest of the team there, and what a life-changing experience. It was kind of hard to talk about without much emotion because it was a miracle that it happened, that for 9 years, Don and the director of the museum at that time, Campbell Gray, negotiated with these parishes, churches in Denmark and Sweden, to bring the paintings here. At the time this all began, BYU had just purchased through an amazing donor the Christ Healing at the Pool of Bethesda, which is a very large altar painting, one of these works that would have been in an altar area of a church. That particular work was in the Bethesda Indre Mission in Copenhagen. And they were remodeling, going to turn it into more of a civic kind of service center. And so they didn't necessarily want a big religious painting there. So at that time, BYU was notified, was able to purchase that painting. And when the donor talked to us about it, he said, what if we got some more Carl Bloch paintings to come to BYU? And you have to recognize an altar painting is the focal point of some of these small churches, that a very large painting right at the center of the church. Of course, we don't have artwork in our buildings, and so we don't recognize as much. But behind where the pulpit would be in our building, and where, of course, the table for Eucharist or sacrament is there, communion, that they have these beautiful paintings that the parish members can come in and think about. And so to ask to take those from those buildings for a length of time was a difficult decision for them to make, to allow them. But because of, I think, some fine negotiating, but also a wonderful presence of the Spirit in those negotiations, that they agreed to send them here. In addition to the one large altar painting that BYU owns, there were four others that came, and several of Carl Bloch's smaller or, you know, less grand works, but significant works as well. So it was one of those singular moments that this won't happen again. In fact, they had hoped to exhibit these in Denmark, but it looks like now that may not happen. But some of those Danish guests have come here, have just reveled in how amazing this exhibition has been. And so it's one of those times that if people did not get to experience it, that I hope they take a look at the works and they go to the Carl Bloch website at BYU to look at them. A little side note, if I can just ramble
Please.
On here, because it was such a wonderful opportunity. We were asking throughout the period when we were working on this, what has it been about Carl Bloch that has resonated so strongly with members of the church? And here is a Lutheran artist in Denmark, which is not the very center of even religious art as we would think of it in Europe. why has Karl Bloch been so important and so well received by the LDS people? And we went back again to ferreting out this history. Don Fazey especially got into records and searched out the beginnings of the relationship of the church with Karl Bloch and traced it back to the 1950s when the church started using some of his works in, at that time, the Improvement Era. They were asked to illustrate a story for the young men, young women at that time, the section in the Improvement Era, on the life of the Savior. And so someone, we're not sure who, but we know that J. Todd and Doyle Green decided to use these works, whether someone had seen Karl Bloch's other paintings at Frederiksborg Castle. But at that point, they started using Karl Bloch's work, got permission to use them over the years, and people just enjoyed seeing this representation of the Savior, a masculine image of the Savior, very compassionate, kind. Karl Bloch himself, I think the artist, really shows through in these paintings. He was a loving father. He was tender, compassionate. When he would see someone struggling, he would go out of his way to help. So I think his own personality comes through in these representations of the Savior. So as you look at Christ with this young child, or it's the Savior in Gethsemane, you do get a sense that this artist cared very deeply himself for the Savior and wanted to express that in those works.
Again, coming back to the Oscar Wilde quote, "Every portrait that is painted with feeling is a portrait of the artist, not of the sitter." This has been a fun time, Rita. Thank you for being here. What else would you want to share with us before we close? About the Church Museum.
About the Church Museum, that I really feel a great sense of mission in sharing with our members around the world and, of course, other people interested in fine, uplifting work, that the more we know about the art, the more we appreciate it. And once we have a sense of it, it can really have a great power in our lives for good, that we can see art as sometimes being life-changing, leading us to think good, virtuous thoughts, helping us understand better some of the scriptural doctrinal principles of the church, and most of all, of feeling that sense of being nourished and fed, as you mentioned, in looking at those other works, that we really can be fed as we experience great works of art.
We've been visiting today with Rita Wright, Church History Museum Curator of Art and Artifacts. Thank you very, very much, Rita, for being with us.
Thank you for having me.